Happy Friday, everyone. Today's show is a collection of some of our favorite recent interviews, so enjoy. And since it's not live, we won't be taking your calls today, but you can always continue the conversation on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC, or on the website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Recently, NASA's Cassini spacecraft dove between Saturn and its rings, snapping the closest ever views of Saturn's atmosphere. Now, Saturn happens to be the favorite planet of my next guest, who, if you happen to be a resident of planet Earth, you have surely heard of. Neil deGrasse Tyson is the world-renowned astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, and host of Star Talk on TV. His new book is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome back to WNYC, and thanks so much for coming in.
Always good to be on your show.
Okay, we're in a hurry. We have 6 minutes.
We're in a hurry.
Fill us in on astrophysics. No, I'm kidding. When I started reading this book, and it starts way at the beginning, like the Big Bang beginning, I thought this would be another brief history of the universe sort of book, which is great, but not particularly, you know, of the moment. But when I got to your last chapter on cosmic perspective, I thought this is something people could use to think about right now. Can you define cosmic perspective as a unit in the book?
Yeah, so a cosmic perspective is something that I guess I occasionally take for granted as an astrophysicist, but it's a perspective that I and all of my colleagues carry with us at all times. And it's an understanding of where Earth and life on Earth and we as individuals, where we fit in the great unfolding cosmic story. And so much of what we have learned about where we fit is quite effective at dismantling people's egos. If you walk into the room saying, I'm special, I'm different, I'm important, and you learn, well, actually, and I'd give just some examples. By the way, a cosmic perspective doesn't have to come from the universe specifically. It can come from chemistry or biology. And I'll give one example of each. So please. In your lower gut, in one linear centimeter of your lower colon, lives and works more microbes than the total number of humans who have ever been born. So if as a human you're saying, well, we're at the top and we're in charge, then those microbes have a different outlook on that statement, because all you are to them is a dark anaerobic vessel of fecal matter. And if you get them upset, they will let you know that they're there. But
this is not where I thought we'd be going.
But what's important is you realize that if you want to think you are separate and distinct and more important, the information that this many microbes lives within your gut, that you're sharing the same vessel, your body, is a reminder that we are participant in the biosphere. And we need each other. We and these microbes require one another for their own survival. So you cannot walk around saying, I am more important than some other kind of life form just because I'm bigger. That's a biological element.
Because we all know those microbes in our gut can bring us to our knees.
Yeah, Kirk, exactly. And then you look at the elements in our body. This is well known. They're traceable to stars that have exploded across the galaxy and across time. And so you want to think we're special being life on Earth when we're made of the most common ingredients in the universe. And then you look out into the universe and you say, well, we're a special Earth. And we think there's countless thousands, likely trillions of planets in the solar system. We're not likely to be alone at all. And so that, to some people, can be depressing. But I take a different outlook and I say, why have you defined your importance by how different you are, when in fact, for me, I feel elevated learning how similar we are to one another genetically, to the universe atomically, to anything else on Earth from molecularly, to the fact that we have ingredients in common with stars. We are not only figuratively, we are also literally stardust. And so for me, that elevates my ego, not as an individual, but just as a member of this universe. And the entire last chapter of the dozen chapters is a celebration. It's a reality check on your ego and a celebration of how thinking this way can be completely humbling and uplifting at the same time.
And you tell a story about a letter you received from a professor of psychology whose expertise was in things that could make people feel insignificant. I didn't know somebody could specialize in exactly that, but he wanted to administer a before and after questionnaire to visitors assessing their depth of depression after viewing the Hayden Planetarium show, Passport to the Universe. Now, this was back in 2000. I don't even think you were there yet.
No, I was there from the very beginning. I was brought on to help rebuild the place. Oh, yeah. So I've been there since 90s. Five,
okay.
Actually.
So you remember this?
Oh, no, that letter came to me. That's what that...
Oh, right, of course. You got that letter.
Yeah. So it was a professor of psychology who had just come to the newly opened Rose Center for Earth and Space, where we had a brand new planetarium called Passport to the Universe that was co-written by Steve Soter and Ann Druyan, who were two of the three co-writers of the original Cosmos and of the Cosmos that I had the privilege of hosting. So they have tremendous... writing skills to communicate not only ideas but feeling. And so in this show, the opening show, it included a zoom out from Earth's surface to the edge of the universe, where we sort of dangle you there for a bit before you come back. And everything you knew and loved just disappears to oblivion in this zoom out. And so this letter wanted to just check people's psychological state before they entered and when they exited.
And what did he find?
No, I didn't agree to the study.
Oh.
Nothing against it at the time. I thought it was intriguing, but we were so busy with the opening of the new facility. And that letter came within a month after opening day, and we had to get the bugs out and the like. But I can tell you this, if you think that's what would or should happen to people after they walked in and then walked out, it's because you assert that we thrive on an ego of importance, and that knowing that we are small in space, time, and all these other dimensions, that if you are sure that will depress you, maybe the issue was not having learned what our actual place is in the universe. Maybe the issue is that you had an unjustifiably too high ego to begin with. You should go back and work on your ego. Then return, and then you'll conclude you don't need to administer the experiment at all.
Listeners, your questions for Neil deGrasse Tyson. His new book is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. There are already some political-related questions coming in, and we will take some of those. But anything else for Neil deGrasse Tyson? 212-433-9692. Let me ask you an actual astrophysics question from the book. You write, dark matter is our frenemy. What do you mean by that?
So dark matter is the longest unsolved problem in astrophysics. It may be the longest unsolved problem in all of science. We identified this issue in the 1930s. And it's been, 80 years since then. And we are no closer to an answer for what dark matter is. Dark matter is what we call dark matter. Don't get too married to the term. Because since we don't know what it is, we really shouldn't have named it anything that might bias you. And I want to go on a campaign and call it just Fred or Wilma. Something where there's no...
Not indicted.
Yeah. So what our observations show us, that about 85% of all the gravity manifesting in the universe has no known origin. We add up black holes and planets and comets and galaxies and stars and gas clouds, everything we know and love and can describe and understand and see with our telescopes, and it comes to 1/6 of all the gravity that we see. All the rest, we just call it dark matter. And so it's perplexing. And we scratch our head every day over it. But now when we want to create models of how the universe formed from the Big Bang through the formation, which is the formation of the universe, through formation of galaxies, when we model this on a computer and we put in all the stars and gas and all these things, none of the models work unless we by hand put in dark matter. so that it enables us to understand our models. Its existence, we cannot dust it under the rug. It helps us understand everything else that's happening, even though we don't understand it itself. And that's why I think of it as a frenemy.
You're also right that a small minority of astrophysicists are unconvinced and have suggested there is no dark matter and that we need to modify Newton's law of gravity. Would you say this is akin to the small minority of scientists who are skeptical of climate change or something like that?
Oh, no, because we still don't know anything about dark matter. So since we don't know anything, you know, just line up and bring in your ideas to help this out. When I say it's a small minority, the over-under on this is that it's likely going to be some new class of particle that hardly interacts at all with the particles we know and love, a new sort of class of matter out there. That's where if you're a betting person, that's where you put your money. To say that our laws of gravity need adjustment, what we have found is you have to just adjust it in different ways in different situations to explain what's going on, and that's kind of an unsatisfying solution. You would hope or expect that you come up with one solution that explains all the cases. And so, but if it's piece by piece, it's less satisfying. But they're still out there. And, you know, line up. If you've got a new idea, line up. We'll take it.
Amy in East Hanover, you're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hi, Amy.
Good morning, Dr. Neil deGrasse, and good morning, Brian. I had a question. The Codename God book by Mani Vaumik, he did introduce in United States, in that in cosmos, we are all interrelated, and there is no single entity which is not connected to the other entities. Are you familiar with Codename God, sir?
I'm not familiar with the book, but I can tell you that there are, in fact, entities that are not at all connected to other entities in the universe. And there's a whole vocabulary that we have that describes this. You are either causally connected or not causally connected, and it has to do with the limits on the speed of light. So any such proclamation about the universe would be false, an objectively false proclamation. But there's so much else that is connected that it's fun and important to celebrate that. As I said earlier, we're connected genetically to all other life on Earth. So it still gets you a long way coming at the problem knowing that this is true. But otherwise, it's not a proclamation that you would apply across the entire universe.
We continue with Neil deGrasse Tyson. His new book is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Let's take another call. Tim in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing? Hi, Neil.
Hello.
So I was in Wichita, Kansas this summer, walking into Exploration Place at Children's Science Museum, and on the entrance, walking into all the exhibits, the whole museum, there is a sign on the wall that says, "Attention, these exhibits contain references to extended geologic time." And it seemed very evident that this was a carefully, politically softened trigger warning for people who didn't want to see their children to see any evidence that the world was more than 5,000 years old. What I'm wondering is this normal? Is this a thing that's happening now? And two, you know, what's your take on how curators, you know, as somebody who runs a science museum, so to speak, what's your take on how people who run science museums should deal with pressures like this?
Now, that's a great question. So clearly this concept of trigger warning is a bigger, broader element in today's society than what would be used in a museum. Of course, as you know, on college campuses, it's risen to become a significant element of courses that are offered, of speakers that are invited to speak, and there's safe rooms, or that's not what they call it.
Right. Although I'm a little bit skeptical of the caller putting this in the context of trigger warnings. It sounds like, because trigger warnings, you know, are if something is going to come up that refers to rape, and there might be somebody in the room who's been raped and would be re-traumatized by it, or genocide, and you come from a certain background, this seems to be a warning for people who don't want to expose their children to the science of evolution because they're religious fundamentalists.
Correct. And so this is a free country with freedom of thought and speech, and there's no law requiring what you must teach your children, and all education is local. So you can stack a school board and take science out of the curriculum and put in whatever religious philosophies you choose. And I don't know that a law can prevent you from doing that. And so what all I would say is that if that's the county that you want to create, or if that's the state that you want to foster, then in the 21st century, where innovations in science and technology will be the engines of tomorrow's growth economies, you have just bankrupted the future of your state relative to other states in the nation.
Huh.
And if that happens, if that spreads, then we basically jeopardize the financial health of the nation relative to other nations in the world.
Yeah.
So that's why I'll just tell you that. And otherwise, you know, it's a free country. So
do you think that that is happening a lot, which was one of the things that the caller is curious about? Is this the first instance of that kind of sort of warning that this might violate your religious beliefs?
No, a bigger issue is not that a science museum has a warning, but that there are entire other museums that show humans coexisting with dinosaurs.
Uh-huh.
Okay? let's not ignore the 900-pound gorilla standing there in front of you. So
900-pound brontosaurus.
Brontosaurus, right. And so comedians joke about this, that you go into that museum and somehow they thought that the Flintstones was a documentary. And so... So it's, again, in a free society, this should be free. I mean, you should be able to just do that. But if you do it to the exclusion of knowing what science is and how science works, then you are undermining our capacity to protect our health, to grow our wealth, and to establish security, all three of which will flow through STEM fields going forward into this next century. And not from how many soldiers you have, or not from how much you pray to get rid of your cancer. So we just need to be very real about this. And if you know that you are bankrupting the future of your state and you still want to do it, again, it's a free country. I'm not going to stand in your way.
Christine in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hi, Christine.
Hi there. I know that Dr. Tyson probably is on all kinds of committees, and I was just wondering if he had any intuition or information about how funding for scientific research will fare under the Trump administration.
That's a great question. And so I don't have a crystal ball, but there is a committee I'm on. I'm on a board of the Pentagon. It's called the Defense Innovation Board, where we are trying to sort of modernize how the Pentagon thinks about our security as a nation, possibly drawing from the frontier of science and technological innovations that industry has benefited from over the recent decades, especially IT, because cybersecurity is an emergent, important threat. So there's that. And I can tell you that across the aisle, people have known that science matters. And if you look at science agencies that have been created under the United States government in the past 150 years, beginning with the National Academy of Sciences itself, put into effect under Abraham Lincoln in 1863, when he clearly had something better to think about, well, not better, but had clearly something more important to think about in life, such as the Civil War and the Gettysburg battle, he signs into law the National Academy of Sciences, prescribing advice from an independent committees of scientists to hand the executive branch and the legislative branch. And you move forward and you get the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and the Environmental Protection Agency itself signed into law under President Nixon, a Republican president, I might add. And NOAA comes into play. NASA is founded under Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican president. So it's not like Republicans have never heard about science. They've been participants in this exercise over the decades, going back to Lincoln himself. So if someone doesn't want to, if someone wants to stand in denial of science, they can't really do that because of political legacy that they were carrying forward. They're doing it out of modern day profound ignorance of what science is and how and why it works. Under the Trump administration, my hope there is he's fundamentally a businessman. And any business person knows that you need R&D to protect the future of your corporation. And if you want to think of the USA as corporation, you know, USA Inc., then it seems to me it should be easy to convince him that fundamental investments in basic research will assure the future of America, make sure we start out making America smart again so that you can then fulfill your promise of making America great again.
He does seem to have some interest in cosmology, or at least Mars. And I'm going to play a short clip during a live video conference between Trump and veteran astronaut Peggy Whitson, who's currently aboard the International Space Station. Trump asked Whitson when it would be possible to send a human to Mars. She gave a careful and detailed answer, explaining that a trip to the Red Planet might be possible sometime in the 2030s. And here's how Trump responded.
Well, we want to try and do it during my first term, or at worst, during my second term. So we'll have to speed that up a little bit, okay?
We'll do our best.
What do you make of
it? That's a charming answer, and I know he knew that he was joking. It's you'd have to design, fund, and build the spacecraft, and you'd establish the next generation astronaut class. What's interesting about the 2030s is that the astronauts who would be flying to Mars in the 2030s, if we pull this off, you're going to be finding some of them in middle school today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just an interesting fact. And I always thought it...
In other words, fund science education.
Yeah, exactly. So if you said, we are now choosing the astronauts who will go to Mars in the 2030s, and they're in middle school, let's select them, they'd be like the modern version of the Mercury 7. And how they do it in their math class? And are they eating, three squares a day? So there would be an interesting shift in the culture of the United States to something that resembles what we knew was driving our technological powers of the 1960s.
Among possible missions or areas of research, how high a priority would Mars be for you?
I have a slightly contrarian view, or not contrarian, a slightly altered view from that. My opinion is that the entire solar system should be our backyard, and that you don't select destinations to focus on, you select capacity to explore as what you focus on. And in that capacity, you get, in this example, a suite of launch vehicles. Oh, you want to go to Mars? That would be two from column A, three boosters, and one main engine. Oh, you want to go to the moon and set up a colony? That's this other set. Oh, you want to go to an asteroid and mine it and possibly be the first trillionaire there ever was, mine it for its natural resources that are otherwise rare on Earth? That's this set of launch vehicles. And this could be a burgeoning launch vehicle industry that serves private enterprise, tourists, as well as the government. And then Mars is just one of these places that you choose to go, be it for scientific reasons, for touristic reasons, or even possibly in the interest of national security.
So how do we get to that point? Is that something that the government doesn't even need to decide on? It sounds like you're saying that industry could, start to set up that capacity and create options.
Yeah, so there's a lot in what in that short sentence you just uttered. I'll just briefly unpack it. There's a lot of journalistic account of this new wave of enthusiasm for corporate interest in space. And their assumption, which I'm quite certain is just false, is that these companies will lead the frontier of space exploration. There is no business case to do it first. And so generally, when you do expensive things first, it's done by governments, with whatever other support they can assemble. Then you find out what it actually costs for having done it first and what the actual dangers are. And then you can quantify what the return on that investment must be. Then private enterprise comes in later. So the first humans on Mars will likely be funded by the government, but possibly on a spaceship made by SpaceX or whomever else. That's a perfectly legitimate business model, but it's not a pure tax-independent model, because we would be buying SpaceX's ships with our tax money. A pure space industry would be, I have my vacation money, and I want to go to the moon, and I spend that money on the SpaceX voyage. So, but if that never occurs, and it's all government money, plenty of industry has thrived for decades on this, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and the like.
We're just about out of time. I do want to ask if you read Bret Stephens' first column as a New York Times columnist. The conservative columnist used to be at the Wall Street Journal. called Climate of Complete Certainty, which received so much backlash, as I suspect you know. There was his idea that through the science of that, although the science of climate change is indisputable, the scientific community acts too assuredly when it comes to predicting the ultimate effects of climate change and therefore what policy should be. And he said, quote, ordinary citizens also have a right to be skeptical of an overweening scientism. And I don't know if you want to get into the weeds on climate science, but I thought almost from a meta standpoint, this idea of ordinary citizens feeling like there is an overweening scientism that somehow oppresses them as a scientist. What do you think about that?
Let me go even higher than that and say if the New York Times wanted to bring in political diversity to their point of view so that they're not branded as a leftist, liberal, commie mouthpiece, sure, I think any opinion page should represent the spectrum of opinions. I think the problem here is what I think what should have happened on that opinion page is, given global warming, let me tell you how a conservative would put legislation into effect to address this issue. We would put in carbon credits, or we would not, or we would levy tariffs on Chinese solar panels, or we would build an industry, a green industry, in this way rather than the way the Democrats want. That's what should be happening on an opinion page if you want to claim you have diversity of thought. Not figuring out another way to stand in doubt of what scientists are trying to tell the public. Now, about this uncertainty, one of the problems is journalists do not have a lexicon to report on the true uncertainties that come out of scientific data or scientific modeling. When scientists speak to one another, it is there. It is the first thing we ask you. And you say, well, there's a the water levels will rise 3 inches in the next century. And I'll say, well, what is your uncertainty on that? That's the first thing you ask. And
any scientific study comes with usually a 95% certainty in order to get published or 99% certainty in better cases.
Correct. And so there's no way. Now, by the way, journalism did make that leap with regard to polling. Okay, we are old enough to remember the transition between this candidate A leads 60 to 40.
Great no, example.
60 plus or minus 3 percentage points.
Right.
So it's not an impossible thing to do. So there needs to be more of that to convey the honesty of what's actually happening in the scientific community. But the consensus, not of opinion, but of observation and measurement, is what people really should be paying attention to, the scientific consensus. Without it, you're just making stuff up. And you are building a house of cards, which above a certain floor level will most assuredly collapse.
Neil deGrasse Tyson's latest book is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. And I'd love to hear more astrophysics, but I really got to go.
Yeah, as do I. But thank you for having me.
Thank you
Always
so
good
much.
Always good to be on your show.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org, click on Brian Lehrer show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and when African Americans speak out against police brutality, the response from defenders of the criminal justice system as it is often that blacks are perpetually concerned about police violence while apathetic about black crime. President Trump's constant use of Chicago gang violence is a prominent current example. But my next guest writes in his new book that far from ignoring the issue of crime by blacks against other blacks, African-American officials and their constituents have been consumed by it, and this fixation on crime contributed significantly to some of the criminal justice policies that resulted in mass incarceration. James Forman, Yale Law School professor, tells this story in his new book through the lens of his time as a public defender in Washington, D.C., a district with black leadership at every level of its government. The book is titled Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. Professor Forman, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Why did you feel it was important to write this book about African Americans' influence on mass incarceration?
Well, partially, I'm the kind of person who, when I go to a movie with friends and the movie's over, and if there are no black characters in the movie and people say, you know, what did you think about the movie? And I always say, like, where are the black characters? So in law, in history, in film, in theater, I always want to have African Americans at the center of the narrative. In this case in particular, there's a particular reason, which is I started my work as a public defender in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s. I had taken the job because I viewed it as the civil rights struggle of my generation. My parents met in SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and here I was as somebody with incredible opportunities available to me, clerking on the Supreme Court. And then I see one in three young black men in the criminal justice system. And so I think I need to go do this work because it's the criminal justice work of my era. I get to D.C. and what I see is a lot of people who don't necessarily agree with me. Some who did, but I had a number of cases. One I write about in the book, a young man facing a gun charge and a drug charge. And the African-American prosecutor was asking for him to be locked up. I was asking for him to be released. I had letters from teachers and counselors. The African-American judge who had to rule on the case, before he ruled, he looked into my clients, deep into his eyes. His name was Brandon. And he said, young man, Mr. Foreman has been telling me that you've had a hard life. But let me tell you about hard. And the judge starts to talk about Jim Crow, and he starts to talk about segregation. And then he says, so see, here's the thing. People fought and marched and died for you to be free. And they didn't die for you to be out there running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your family, embarrassing your community. And he locked them up. And I thought, this judge is not alone. Let me tell the story, the complicated, nuanced story of how this African-American community came to support so many tough-on-crime measures.
So let me open up the phones, particularly for black listeners in this case, on that dilemma that Professor Foreman is laying out, if you consider it a dilemma. On the one hand, you didn't fight against Jim Crow, or your parents or grandparents didn't fight against Jim Crow, so that today's kids could go out and commit crime. On the other hand, it's the new civil rights movement to deal with the excessive locking up of today's generation of young African Americans by the criminal justice system. 212-433-WNYC. Is it a dilemma for you? 212-433-9692. For Yale Law Professor James Foreman, whose new book is Locking Up Our Own: Crime and Punishment in Black America. 212-433-9692. So you took the public defender job, seeing that as the front lines of the civil rights movement in the 1990s, and you were surprised by what the black prosecutor and the black judge saw as the same case. Did this influence your own thinking?
It didn't, in terms of it didn't change my view that we've gone down the wrong path in this country, that we've gone down a punitive, harsh path, and that that has created devastation in so many pockets of America, especially in black communities. So that didn't change. It didn't change my view that what we need to have is a more humane, more restorative, more rehabilitation-oriented criminal justice system. Didn't change my view about any of that. The one area I'd say where my view did change is when I was a public defender and I was confronted with people like, Judge Walker in this story, I was so angry at his position. And I basically ascribed kind of Uncle Tom sort of motives. I mean, I knew there were black people who supported these laws, but I was like, all right, well, they're kind of sellouts, you know? And when I went back to do the research and I went back to the 1970s and I saw the levels of crime and violence that the community was consumed by, the heroin addiction, right? The homicide rate tripled in D.C. in the late 1960s. It doubled in most other American cities. And then you get this newly enfranchised group of black elected officials, and they're struggling to do something, right? They need to respond. Their constituents are demanding a response. They're under this pressure, And so in a lot of ways, my story is about trying to put myself in the shoes of the people kind of at the time, like understand the world that that judge was confronted with.
Right.
So I have more sympathy, even though I have no more agreement.
And this came up, as I'm sure you know, in the context of the presidential race last year, when Hillary Clinton was getting hammered by Black Lives Matter and other progressives for having been there when her husband signed the big crime bill of the 1990s that was seen as contributing so much to mass incarceration. Some of the pushback on that was that, well, a lot of local African-American officials in cities all over the country were calling for, or at least in agreement, that something had to be done because that times were different then. That was the height of the crack epidemic, or the 80s going into the earliest 90s. And crime was on the rise. And since then, crime has come way down. So it's time to view mass incarceration in a different kind of light. But that, you know, the idea was around that it's a revisionist take on history to say they never should have had that kind of conversation and never should have signed that crime bill in the 1990s because things were objectively really worse.
They were. And I guess I have two things about that. One is when we talk about these elected officials, I think one, the African-American elected officials in particular, one thing we have to be clear on is how almost every person I encounter is that's asking for more police and prisons and prosecution is also asking for an attention to root causes. They're also asking for a Marshall Plan for urban America. They're asking for more investment in schools, in job training, in mental health training, in housing, in fighting segregation. So I do think we have to be fair and admit that they didn't get that aspect of what they were asking for. They had an all-of-the-above solution, and they got really one of the above. The other thing I would say about Secretary Clinton is I watched that moment very carefully, and I understood what she was trying to say, but I wish she had said something a little bit different. I wish she had been a little bit more connected to that emotional pain of those protesters and said and tied into her own pain and said, you know what? Let me tell you where I was in the 90s, and let me tell you the pain and suffering and violence that I saw myself responding to. And you know what? That caused a lot of people to go too far, including me. And it caused us to say things that were wrong, and Super Predator was wrong. And I'm sorry, right? If she had done that, which is really kind of behind what she was saying, but she didn't say it like that. And I felt like if she had, people are prepared to understand, okay, you made a mistake. I get it. You were under pressure. And now you want to do different. Let's talk about that.
So she wasn't elected. Donald Trump was. He appointed Jeff Sessions attorney general. And now Jeff Sessions has appointed as one of his top deputies on crime this guy named Stephen Cook, who's calling pretty explicitly for a return to the era of mass incarceration. Here is 30 seconds of Stephen Cook from a Washington Post video.
What we did beginning in 1985 or along in there is put these laws to work. And what we did by putting them to work is we started filling the federal prisons, not state prisons, federal prisons, with the worst of the worst. And what happened is exactly what Congress said they wanted to happen, and that is violent crime began in 1991, began to turn around. By 2014, we'd cut it in half. That's what the system is doing, and it's designed to do, and it's working exactly as it is.
Now, we've used that cut here before, but for those of you who haven't heard it, that is our new Deputy Attorney General, Stephen Cook. So get to know him, because it seems like he's very influential and there to implement a lot of what Jeff Sessions believes. So from your point of view and with your understanding of history, Professor Foreman, how much have those mass incarceration policies even been rolled back? And how much can a U.S. Attorney General restore it to the glory days of what he called, law enforcement policies in 1985?
Right. So I have two messages. One would be to Mr. Cook directly, and then one would be to the rest of us as citizens. So to Mr. Cook, I would just say that his use of statistics is wrong and is misleading. It is true that crime has declined. But it's also true that it's declined in many jurisdictions including New York State, that have dramatically reduced the size of their prison populations. Still too large, still under terrible and in many cases kind of inhumane conditions. But we've seen many, many states where crime keeps going down as prison population goes down. So this idea that you have to have a rising prison population to reduce crime is just wrong. The other thing I would say to him is, even if it's true that rising incarceration rates are part of what explains the crime reduction, the question we always have to ask is, what's the most humane, least harmful way of reducing crime? So it would certainly, I think, be true that if you lock everybody up, then on the streets anyway, you won't have any more crime. You'll have crime in prison, but that, of course, we say, well, that's, you know, that's crazy. And so it's the same idea. Do we want to rely on prison, or do we want to rely on the kind of investments that actually reduce crime? But to the rest of us, which is really, I'd rather speak to the rest of us, because I don't think he's going to change his mind. To the rest of us, what I would say is, our problem of mass incarceration was one that was built fundamentally in cities, counties, and states, and not at the federal government level. And that's how we're going to have to reduce it. 88% of prisoners in this country are in state and local facilities, not federal prisons.
That's just what I was going to say as a follow-up. And he made that point. I don't know if you heard it, because you probably didn't hear that clip before. But he emphasized in federal prisons, mm-hmm. they did that with the worst of the worst, as he put it, not state and local prisons, at least as the federal Justice Department was involved. And that same point came up in that same Hillary Clinton conversation during the presidential campaign, that Bill Clinton couldn't have been responsible for mass incarceration, because mass incarceration was overwhelmingly a state and local phenomenon, because the overwhelming amount of crimes, you know, they're not federal crimes. All these drug crimes and stuff, mostly, and other violent crimes, mostly they're local crimes, and they're tried in state court. Is that true?
Well, it's true. That's partially true. It is true that cities and state governments are – that's where the prisoners are. That's where we incarcerate people. But – anybody who starts a sentence that says, I'm not responsible in this issue, I want to challenge them off the top, because we're all responsible. In my view, to say that, you know, federal prisoners are 10 or 12%, so therefore I'm not responsible, first of all, ignores things like the incentives that the federal government gave, right? They gave certain money to states if they agreed to do things like get rid of parole. So the federal government can influence what states do. But really, the bigger picture is, we all built this system as a nation, in every city, in any county, across political lines, across racial lines. Some people bear more responsibility than others, but we all bear some responsibility, and that gives us all an opportunity. It gives us all an opportunity to participate in the rolling back.
We continue with James Forman, Yale Law Professor, author now of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, Naja in Jamaica, Queens. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm a longtime listener, first time calling. So, yeah, thanks.
So glad you're on.
So, yeah. I just wanted to start off with the first question that you had. So I was actually living in D.C. A couple of years ago, attending Georgetown, and I was, you know, hanging with some people, allowed some of them to stay at my house because it was a really bad snowstorm, figured wait till the morning. So when I woke up, found that my PlayStation was about to be stolen, but my laptop was stolen. Long story short, I got my laptop back, and when the prosecutor asked me, well, what did I want to see happen to the young guy, I said, I don't want him to go to jail. Because, you know, like, I got my stuff back. I just want him to learn a lesson. So, like, probation, some kind of, like, anything. Because he was explaining to me, well, oh, I have kids, and I have to do this, and I have to feed them. And I'm saying, that's not my problem. You know, that's unfortunate. And he was kind of saying, to the extent of, well, you have everything. You have a place. You have a job. I'm like, I understand that. I'm struggling the same. It might be on a different level, but my struggle is just as tough. And so, like, I didn't want to see another person go to jail just for something simple. I got my stuff back. It's not that bad. And then even when, because I lived in Southeast D.C. for a little bit just because the rent was cheaper, and I just saw how they live. Like, a lot of them are, it's just, like, every person for themselves. Like, I have to do, you know, I have to do this, or I have to steal. Like, a lot of that rhetoric was happening there. It's like, well, you know, and even just, like, the way how the city is made, like, down there is just, it looks very different than, say, you go a little bit over into Capitol Hill.
So now, John, I'm going to jump in just for time. When you got to that point of seeing that the guy who stole from you was going to be come down on by the criminal justice system, you got ambivalent?
Well, yeah. Like, I, you know, when I actually had to face that decision, it was, well, you know, I want to see justice, but I also don't want to see, you know, another bad thing happen to a brother of mine, you know?
How'd it work out?
I don't know exactly, but it sounded like he may have gotten probation because he was still in contact with me, but I ignored him. But yeah, it seemed like it was just probation that he was on for some time. And then I left the, where I was living and left the city.
And that's an okay outcome as far as you were concerned.
Right. I'm fine. Like, my main thing was getting my computer back because I was in school and, you know, just him having some responsibility mm-hmm. for what he did and for his actions, regardless of the reason why.
Thank you so much for your call. Please call us again. Let's go to Kylie in Montclair. Kylie, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. So I wanted to call because I was actually raised kind of with this tension my entire life. So my sisters and I grew up in Plainfield, New Jersey, and my dad and his friends would always have this constant argument about what to do with kind of truants and you know, bad behavior in schools. And my dad's perspective was always, you know, kick them out, lock them up. Like, I send my daughters to school. I need the schools to be safe. And his friend was always like, well, what is our responsibility as kind of middle-class Black people to these young men who are, you know, having this trouble? Like, we can't just kick them out. But my dad's perspective was, listen, we can talk about solutions, but not at the hands of my daughters. I send my daughters to the school. The school, the town needs to be safe. And so this tension has been present in my life, you know, since I was a child.
So Kylie lived the tension that you're writing about in your book.
Yeah, and Kylie, I feel like this book is written for you and for people like you. I mean, I hope everybody reads it. Of course, every author wants that. But you're who I have in mind, principally. That is to say, you know, African-Americans who are very aware of exactly this tension. And I feel like, you know, where I come down, ultimately, the message of the book, right, is a message of probably more towards your dad's friend in the sense of ultimately what I think the solution should be, more towards restoration, more towards keeping kids in school, more towards rehabilitation and restorative justice. But at the same time, of course, there has to be accountability. One of the things that I think is interesting is when you ask victims of crime, like for 40 or 50 years, we've basically built this rough, tough, brutal in many ways criminal justice system on the theory that this is what crime victims want. And it turns out when you do the research, if you tell most people that are victims of crime that they have a choice between prison or nothing, they take prison. But if you ask people, and the Alliance for Safety and Justice has done a lot of research in the last year interviewing crime victims, especially crime victims of color around the country, and what they say, when they ask people if they want a choice between prison or job training, mental health treatment, drug treatment, those sorts of opportunities, people then say by a 2 to 3 to 1 margin, well, we want the problem fixed rather than have the person simply incarcerated. So I think that's kind of the work of the next decade, is building up some of those alternatives so that we can resolve that tension you described in a more kind of humane way, but that still makes the school safe for those that are trying to learn.
Kylie, thank you, and keep calling us. Just a little more of the history from your book before we run out of time. The list of Black leaders who you mention supporting tough-on-crime policies might surprise some people. Maxine Waters was on this list, Johnny Cochran, Jesse Jackson, Eric Holder. And at the same time, you say that the idea from the 1960s that the solutions to crime included not just law enforcement, but job creation, better education, housing programs, et cetera, that such efforts had become an object of ridicule by 1975, a symbol of the hopeless naivete of 1960s liberalism. Do you think we've come full cycle to where those things aren't considered hopelessly naive anymore, but a central project of, you know, contemporary civil rights movement?
I think we've opened up more space for that. And in part, the declining crime rates have made people, I think, a little bit more willing to have a conversation about mass incarceration and then about what are the other ways we can respond. Because I think that's, you know, fundamentally, like what I was saying to the last caller, we can't not have a response. That's not a plausible position to take when people are suffering and people are scared. So the question is, how are we going to respond? And I do think we're at a moment now where, yeah, people are willing to talk about healthcare and talk about mental health treatment and drug treatment. I mean, with the opioid crisis, and I know people have raised the, you know, and I've raised the kind of racial factors here, but with the opioid crisis, we see that, you know, very straightforwardly, people are starting to talk about the fact that, you know, we need treatment in these instances.
You want to give me maybe just 15, 20 seconds, because that's all we have, on maybe a Jesse Jackson or an Eric Holder, who, you know, there's still people on right-wing radio going on and say, oh, they're the criminals lobby.
Well, Eric Holder was very, very tough on crime. He was the one that brought in this pretext policing where you stop people for any basis, any minor traffic violation, because you want to search for guns. And I think now he's seen some of the costs of that.
James Forman, Yale Law professor, author now of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Time for the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is Columbia University law professor Carol Sanger. Her new book is called About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And a lot of this book, I see, is about how abortion might be protected as a constitutional right under Roe versus Wade, but governments at the state and local level and the federal level still pass laws designed to make a woman considering an abortion feel it's disreputable or immoral. How much is that the main point of your book?
That's a pretty good main point. And part of what I'm trying to do is show women, I think women might be heartened to know that if they feel rotten after having had an abortion, or they feel guilty even thinking about it, or they feel shamed, that it's useful for everyone to know for women to know that there's an entire apparatus of law and social practices meant to bring about exactly that result. So there's nothing inevitable about abortion and wickedness, or abortion and shame.
So let's look at some of these laws. A big category is what you call women's right to know laws. What are they?
They are laws that have so it all depends what women want to know. The name is, of course, meant to seem women-friendly. And I did a little survey of what you'd want to know before you had an abortion, and none of the things in women's right to know laws were on the list that most women want to know about anything. And they're not called what women want to know about abortion. They're just what women want to know. In fact, one person said, I want to know why I earn less than my male counterpart. But that's a different program for you. One of the primary pieces of it are mandatory ultrasound statutes, which require women, before they can give legal consent to an abortion, to not only have an ultrasound, which many doctors do as a matter of course to locate the pregnancy and to date it, but be told by the physician, this is a requirement, would you like to look at the image of your unborn child, and in those languages, in those words. And some states even say the doctor must point out extremities, any identifiable body parts, the heart. And we also have heartbeat laws, which say you must listen to the sound of the the heart.
They must.
The woman must. You must listen to the sound of the heart. You can close your eyes if you don't want to look at the ultrasound. But these laws, we also I'll just give you a so that's one that you have before you consent. You also are told that in Texas and Indiana, a number of states, that you must bury the fetal remains, fetal or embryonic remains. And so those two things bracketed. First, we want to show you that what you're doing is killing your own child. And then at the end, we're going to make you go through a ritual that we reserve for born persons of mourning. And women may, in fact, feel bad about having had to make this decision, but they in no studies have I found have women wanted a do-over. You know, you feel terrible. You wanted, would you change your mind? No, I would do the same thing.
Are there also some states – I think this was an issue in Pennsylvania some years ago, but I don't know if it got instituted where a woman has to see a film or read literature about the potential upsides and downsides, or maybe it's just the potential downsides of having an abortion?
It's done through disclosure requirements. So the downsides, according to some states, are suicidal ideation, a lifetime of guilt, regret, remorse. So it paints a very dark psychological picture. And while some women may take – I believe most women take this decision very seriously and may afterward think about it, reflect upon it, those are not – relief is also a major consequence of having an abortion.
And that's not in the literature.
That's not there. The other thing is – the other sorts of things are telling women, giving them ample information about adoption and also telling them they have the right to compensation and child support from the father or the man they had intercourse with. And many women don't want anything to do with that person.
I always wondered if there's a mandatory information law, why it wouldn't – include the risks and benefits of pregnancy and childbirth and unwanted child rearing, as well as the risks and benefits of abortion if a woman is at that precipice of deciding whether to keep a pregnancy. Does any law balance it like that?
No, they don't. They don't at all. And you would think that that would be something you'd want to know. What are the physical risks? Abortion in the early stages is way more safe, is much safer than childbirth. And this was something the Supreme Court addressed in this decision last summer called Whole Women's Health. It said states have to show now that the laws they are passing are good for women's health. They can't just say it. And so we might be seeing, depending what happens with the Supreme Court, we might be seeing more laws that are more states that are where the legislatures are required to give accurate information.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We have time for a few phone calls if anybody wants to call in for Columbia University Law Professor Carol Sanger, author now of About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Anybody who's ever been through an abortion and been subject to the so-called women's right to know law in any particular state, or maybe as we're about to get into parental right to know laws, if you were a minor, or even maybe partner right to know laws. So we'll get into all of this. And anybody who wants to call with your experience or a question, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Are there sex partner right to know laws?
No, there were. They actually weren't sex partner. They were husband right to know laws. So they figured they couldn't sort of delve into who brought about this pregnancy. They limited it, curiously, just to husbands and wives. And so it was one of the first laws out of the box after Roe v. Wade, laws saying husband had to give consent. And the court said
– consent, not just be informed.
Consent, right. This was one of the first – cases. Then and the court said, no, you didn't read Roe v. Wade carefully enough. It said this is a decision between a woman and her doctor. And even though we acknowledge the father – well, here it would be the husband – might have an interest in the pregnancy, the decision has to be made by the woman because it affects her life and body so much more. But then – what you're thinking of is a case from Pennsylvania where they said, okay, we can outsmart the Supreme Court. Instead of requiring consent, we're just going to require notification. And there, this was a case in 1992 called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, an important case. And the court said, no, notification isn't good either, because we think acknowledging that there are cases of domestic violence, they sort of acknowledge the social fact of domestic violence and decided that notification would give a husband enough to take away the keys, lock her up, bully her, threaten her. Of course, all those laws assume that husbands or fathers would not want the woman to have the abortion. And we have no evidence that that's true.
Or some might not, and that would be as much as they could get, the anti-abortion rights activists.
Yes, yes. But you also asked about parental rights. And parents in, I think, 37 states have laws called parental involvement laws, which say before a girl, a minor under 18, can consent to abortion, she has to either notify her parents or get consent. Different states treat it differently, and in some states she has to notify both, and in some only one. And these are really terrifying a proposition for a young girl who goes to a clinic. Most of them find out when they are able to find a clinic or provider who says, "And please bring the order from the court." They say, "What?" So, and this is not taught.
Court? What? Court?
Yeah, court. How do I get, where, what? And so they manage to find their way. Some of the states have good information online. Some don't. And they'd have to find it out online. Of course, you have to have a computer to do that. So it's a whole network of information they have to get. And then they have to go to court and have a hearing before a judge.
And there's a lot of political pressure to support these things in various states. The first time I interviewed Hillary Clinton was during the 1992 presidential campaign, New York primary season, and she came on the show when the show was just a baby, representing Bill. And one of the things I asked about was her support for parental notification laws in Arkansas at the time, which I think she then changed on.
Well, he didn't. He signed the bill. I mean, he signed it into law in Arkansas. And it's a good thing if she changed. There are many ways you could change it. You could say, let's take out 16 and 17-year-olds. You could say, let them go to someone else. Let them notify another trustworthy adult. There are many ways if you want to have an adult involved in this process and the decision-making to do it that are not so onerous. And most girls do tell their parents, or at least one parent.
We'll continue in a minute with Columbia University Law Professor Carol Sanger, author now of About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Stay with us. WNYC with Columbia University Law Professor Carol Sanger. Her new book, About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. And Mary in Westport, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
You wanted to tell a story?
So a couple years ago, I did help a friend of mine who had an unexpected pregnancy. She knew that was kind of the deal that her and her boyfriend, they had already made the decision to get an abortion, but she just needed help getting through the obstacle course of actually having the procedure done. And what I learned was basically that all of these laws that basically stipulate a waiting period before the patient can consent are totally superfluous, because in most places you have to wait anyway for a doctor to become available.
How did this play out in your friend's case?
Basically, she had to take not one but 2 days off from work in order to go to the clinic, first off, to verify the pregnancy. And then the week after that, we went to the clinic to actually have it done. At that point, we then had to wait all day because the doctor was only in for like one Saturday a month. Mm-hmm. And it was such a long patient roll that, you know, we may have not have even gotten in. We were very lucky because Connecticut's a very small state. But for folks in like Texas, you know, you may have to drive 4-5 hours to get to the nearest clinic and then pay for a room and board.
Right, because there are so few providers.
Well, two problems that the caller has raised. One is the effect of these waiting periods. It was 24 hours in some states, 48 in others, 72. I think one is up to 96. But in any case, what they're kind of infantilizing women, and they're assuming that women choose abortion on a whim. And you come in and you've gone through your own mental processes and checked with your own values and put this decision together for yourself. Then you go there and you find out, you schedule an abortion. When you go, you find out you have to go home. And as the caller said, not too bad in New York City. Well, we don't have that in New York City, but not too bad in places that have are where doctors do perform abortions. When you get to the plain states, there are no providers, and the distances to a clinic are much greater. This means women have to take time off work. They have to find people to take care of their children. They have to either invent a pretty creative lie, you know, visit to explain their absence.
And as Mary was saying, room and board.
And yeah, you check into a motel. I mean, there are motels near clinics.
That far away from your home. Mary, thank you for sharing your story. And Jennifer, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I did endure an abortion many years ago, and I did have to power through picket lines and shouting people. But what it impressed upon me moving forward is the importance of having a discussion with my daughter, who's now 19, and my stepdaughter about birth control and how we all chose to have IUDs placed in them and how important it is, and honest talk. And what is not lost on me is that in this day and age, the 21st century with personhood amendments, that access to birth control so you don't have to be in the position I was in and make that decision may also be at risk. And thank you. I'll take my here.
Thank you very much.
So personhood amendments are a tricky business right now. Interestingly, you might be heartened to know that the last four states that put personhood amendments on their ballots were defeated. So there's something going on, and there might be a disconnect between the population, the constituencies, and the state legislatures themselves. Personhood amendments are an end run around Roe v. Wade because they say, as a matter of constitutional law in this state, an embryo from the time of conception, when it's even less than an embryo, is a legally protected person.
You describe in the book how abortion needs to remain a private decision, but you say it doesn't need to be secret. Why do you distinguish between privacy and secrecy?
Well, that's a good question because I thought about why do women not talk about abortion? Because many don't. I mean, I think Mary did. She said she spoke to her daughter about birth control and so on, and that's the way to go. But many women who suffer, she said she endured an abortion. I would say many women suffer their abortions, suffer the process. The process, if you have 12 weeks or under, takes about 10 minutes, not counting just recuperating for an hour. But the lack of conversation about abortion at the private level, many mothers don't talk to their children. Daughters rarely tell their adult daughters, don't always tell their parents. Husbands, wives don't always tell their husbands. And there are all these other – women go to doctors. They don't use their own OBGYN. They go to a doctor who doesn't know them. So there's all this – you might call that privacy. I would call it secrecy. And the distinction
shame.
That's the distinction. Privacy is sort of powerful. I get to decide who knows what about me. Secrecy is something different. It's non-disclosure because you're scared of what will happen if you disclose.
I think we have a story – kind of to this point. Claire in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling, Claire.
Hi. Yeah, it's very similar to that point. My sister kept a secret of her abortion because of the shame around the entire procedure. She was in college at the time, really needed to have it. It was the best decision she could have made, but she went through the entire process alone, and at the time lived in Florida, so it was really difficult. There's not very many centers. It was an entire process. She had to pay for it out of pocket so it wouldn't show up on my parents' insurance. And I would have normally been the person she would have told, but I had to have a hysterectomy in my teenage years because of some medical issues. And the process of making her listen to the heartbeat and look at the image made her feel so much guilt and shame because of my medical issues that I can't have children. And she felt so much more trauma from being put through that entire process, which was just unnecessary. And it infuriated me so much that she felt she needed to keep that secret, that she needed to feel shame around it, the decision she needed to make. It's not my place to judge.
Because it wasn't your social pressure on her to feel shame. It was society's pressure on her to feel shame relative to you.
Right, which is just not fair.
Claire, and I have to leave it there because we're running out of time, but thank you so much. It was probably not an easy story to share.
Yes, thank you. And I just want to say it's not just society, but it's the law. And so that's worth keeping in mind, that this is all required not because doctors voluntarily do it. They object to a lot of this.
And so for you as a law professor, this is what your book is about, and you're looking at all these laws that even while abortion is a constitutionally protected right under Roe, try to push at the fringes of it through these various information laws and other kinds of things designed to impose shame, et cetera. So in our last 45 seconds, for you as a law professor, Neil Gorsuch, in his confirmation hearing, did refer to Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. Was that any kind of indication to you that he would not vote to overturn it if given the opportunity?
Well, because I want him not to vote to overturn it, I could put a lot of stock in that. It's possible, although his mentor, Antonin Scalia, said he would overturn it. But I think it's an important point that the Casey case, what I talked about earlier, the judges in that case said, if I'd been on the court when Roe was decided, I don't think I would have voted that way. But I'm not. I'm on the court now, and it's the law of the land. And so I think we have to hope he meant that.
Carol Sanger, Columbia University law professor and now the author of About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Hey, do you know about Brian Lehrer Weekend yet? Each week, the producers and I get together and pick three of our favorite segments from the week and package them together for your weekend listening. It's about an hour. Works whether you're doing some cooking, going for a run, on a road trip, whatever. Find it every Friday afternoon on iTunes and our website. Search for Brian Lehrer Weekend. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in a quest for happiness, comedian Paula Poundstone acted as her own test subject, immersing herself in a wide variety of potential happiness-inducing experiments to see if any of them actually held the key to unlocking a blissful state of being which she felt she was missing. Paula Poundstone recorded the findings and shares them in a new book called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Paula Poundstone, as you almost certainly know, is not only a comedian but a regular panelist on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And the title of her most recent book, again, is The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Hi, Paula. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So happiness, it's a word we use a lot. What does it mean to you?
Oh, gee, I'm not even sure. I'll tell you, one thing I discovered, and by the way, my book's number one job is to be funny. I think I pulled it off. I chose to do these experiments in happiness partly because I thought it would be a fun thing to write about, partly because I was hoping I could get the publisher to pay for the experiments, and therefore I would go do fun things that were funded by someone else. But that's
definitely a key to happiness.
That would be a key to happiness. That did not happen. No one took the bait even a little bit on that idea.
You mean this is self-published?
It's not self-published, but I paid for everything.
Okay.
No, not self-published. It's published by Algonquin. But one thing that I did learn, because it was interesting, like any writer, I guess, says, because I've heard them say it before, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, I think you discover things along the way that you didn't know when you started. And one thing that I discovered was that there is a difference between enjoying something and something making you happy. And it may well be that it's all biochemical, which I know isn't a very romantic idea. But the truth is, I could do something that I enjoy, and then when I'm back, thank you. And then when I'm back in my regular life, that didn't have any shelf life to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas there's things that you do that can provide you with, I found particularly in the Get Fit experiment, that I returned to my regular life with the slings and arrows of raising three kids and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. I found that with this grueling workout schedule I was keeping, although it was not fun doing that, that the aftermath of it left me with a feeling of possibility.
And what was the Get Fit experiment? Just how grueling was this?
It was grueling. I did. I took Taekwondo and self defense. And by the way, I never got good at it. The truth is, first of all, there's a lot of left and right involved, and I can't tell left from right. And so, if I were to be attacked, I would need a moment from the attacker to pretend eating. Which is the only way I can tell my right hand from my left.
That could be a problem on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, not being able to tell left from right.
I swing decidedly left on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, despite what questions come up. It wasn't even a matter of mastery. It was just a matter of putting in that much effort, and I think there was a chemical process that happens with endorphins.
And so, for context, for each chapter, you set yourself a new task, and you embark on something that you think might make you happy. So, besides Get Fit, there was Get Organized, and some other ones.
Every chapter is written as a science experiment with a hypothesis and the conditions. And the analysis was when I returned to my regular life, what was happening with raising my kids. And so in essence, it's very memoir-ish, which I get to keep writing memoirs so long as I'm not dead. but it ended up taking 7 years, which was not my original plan, but it did. It took 7 years, and therefore it's the story of raising my children, for one thing.
So for one day out of those 7 years in your unscientific study of the search for happiness, you rented a Lamborghini.
I did. And by the way, it's not the answer. And I only did it because the experiments were things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And I think a lot of people think this idea that, having a fancy sports car would bring you great happiness. It did not. It's not that it wasn't fun here and there. There was a point on the night that I rented it, I picked up my son and we drove through Santa Monica late at night pretending to be cool. And that was fun. But it
seemed like this road to happiness might have actually been more through impressing your son with a Lamborghini than actually getting thrills out of driving a Lamborghini.
Well, that's true. It's true. There was a moment where when I called him up and I told him I rented a Lamborghini, he was so excited. And there was a moment where I felt excited because he felt excited. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I've finally done something that pleased my son. And then – excuse me. I think there's a cough button here somewhere, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
All right. Well, it's too late
right.
now.
People cough.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. When I called him up, I told him he was so excited. And I think he was like I don't know, 16 maybe at the time. And he said, can I drive it? And I just, all my house of cards fell apart. I'm like, well, of course you can't drive it. He didn't have a license, by the way. He didn't even have a permit. He hadn't even opened a page of the drive. It was just a ridiculous question. And it was, it was battle stations after that. It didn't bring me the joy that I was, that other people thought that it might.
My guest is Paula Poundstone. Her new book is The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And listeners, we can take your phone calls for Paula Poundstone at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can talk about your own studies of the search for human happiness or even participatory experiments in your own quest for happiness? Did you take on positive thinking or did you volunteer? Two examples from Paula's book. Or whatever else. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or pretend you're Peter Sagal and ask her a question about the news. 212-433-9692. The serious side of this is that you really were using this ha 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 as somewhat an excuse, or I don't want to say an excuse, or at least a vehicle to also write about your children, your three adopted children. And throughout the book, we really get a sense of them. Do you want to talk about each of them a little bit? Maybe talk about Tosha. Is that how you say her name?
Tosha. Tosha is now 26 years old, which seems inconceivable. She, I give a pretty good description of her in the book, I think. She came to live with me when she was 4 and a half. I've known her since she was 10 months. And I adopted her, I guess, when she was 5, I suppose. And she has cerebral palsy and is the strongest human being I've ever met in my entire life. She's also her own worst enemy. And once she figures that out, she's going to be absolute hell on wheels. One of the chapters is we go backpacking together, and I made her carry a pack. It wasn't a heavy pack; it was a day pack. And I think in the beginning she wanted to go, and as it got closer, it was she was sort of a morose teenager that didn't want to go off on a trip with her mom. And we ended up really having quite a remarkable time, in part because I'm fairly certain we were snuffled by a bear in the middle of the night. Our last night on the trip, I stupidly brought our backpack into the tent because there were squirrels around and I didn't want them eating my Pop-Tarts. And I was convinced that we were no longer in bear country. And so I took the pack, which is apparently a cardinal sin in backpacking, full of, food
when
and stuff.
When there are bears around, I would say so.
Yeah. And so we woke up in the middle of the night with this huge snuffling. It may have been a smaller animal, but I'm pretty certain it was a bear. I never looked out. Tosha kept saying to me, put your head out the door and look. And I just pictured myself putting my head like in a Warner Brothers cartoon right into the into the mouth of a bear. And so instead, we were clinging to each other like Laverne and Shirley. And we had headlamps on, so every time we turned one way or the other, we blinded one another. Instead, what we eventually did was we sang songs loudly from The Harder They Come, because, and this is a well-known fact in the world of outdoors, bears really dislike songs of social struggle.
Really?
So it did. It drove the bear away, and then
did they prefer electronic dance music? Or
more than
do you
likely,
know?
No one prefers electronic dance music. Have you ever been to the ping pong place Spin?
No,
it's fantastic. I love ping pong, but they play electronic, horrible music. I forget where I was, which is exactly what I'm like as a person.
Oh, that's okay. I think you were keeping your
all the time
head out of the bear's mouth. But let's take a phone call. Jadania in the Rockaways, you're on WNYC with Paula Poundstone. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Paula.
Hey.
I have two questions. I wanted to know, are you ever going to go back to stand-up? One. And then the ultimate question is, what did you find, since happiness is like it's such a subjective construct, a state of being, what did you find or did you find your actual key to happiness?
First of all, I've never left stand-up. I've been touring for 38 years. The last time I was in New York, I was at Pace University, and that was probably just a couple months ago. But you have to go on my goofy website, paulapoundstone.com, and see my schedule. I'm not James Brown, but I'm damn near the hardest working woman in show business.
Sounds like you've got to create one of those event alerts on your on the internet for yourself, Jidani. Well, then let's go to Philomena in Westchester. You're on WNYC with Paula Poundstone. Hi, Philomena.
Good morning.
Hey.
Paula, I love you. I went to see one of your shows. I think it was at Queens College a couple of years ago. I think you're incredible. And
thank you.
When you're on.
Was it stand-up? That show?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're just proving this for Jidania.
Yeah, yeah. Jidania had no idea I was still working, for heaven's sakes.
Yes, it was a great show.
Thank you.
And got to tell a lot of people about it. I do a tremendous amount of volunteer work, but part of my job is I'm a dog trainer. And I had a moment today that brought me tears of joy, totally unexpected and insane. I have 40 people coming to my house on Saturday. I could not give up this time. But I was working with this older couple who had to give up their dog. They've only had about 10 days. And yesterday and today, I must have spent 10 or 12 hours trying to find a proper fit. I just left the Bronx, transferring the dog from the owner to the new owner. And we were all crying. So get out there and do things that aren't on your calendar, but you can make a good thing for people, and that brings a lot of joy in life.
The key to happiness, according to Philomena. And if I'm not mistaken, Paul, you're like the animal owner of the universe, aren't you?
I have a lot of animals, but you're absolutely right, by the way. Volunteering is a great thing for all sorts of reasons. Here's one of the things that we seem to have lost sight of, and I last night I walked for miles trying to find a vegan restaurant. And one of the things I can't help making note of is that even since the last time that I had the chance to walk around New York City, which was probably, I don't know, a year or two ago, there's a larger proliferation of people with earphones in, staring at their flat things. And we need each other. We are pack animals. The making eye contact, hi, how are you? Those sorts of things are, you know, life should be like the beginning of Beauty and the Beast. It should be bonjour, bonjour. People should be greeting one another and making contact. And the fact that we're not is a big, huge problem, actually, and really cuts into people's happiness and makes them feel more and more isolated. I think that computers have done, and screen devices have done far more to tear us apart than to connect us. And the irony is that they take words like friendship or friends and connection and sort of bastardize them. I don't know if you can say that on radio, but I did already.
But one of the things that you do in your search for happiness is, I guess, to make a connection with your son, Thomas, is to get wired despite your feelings about computers.
Well, no, actually, people had told me over and over again during the writing of my first book, there's nothing in this book that I meant to say, particularly while I was writing that book, which, by the way, I wrote by hand, and I would give the pages to a typist.
Really?
But people kept saying to me, oh, for years, people said, oh, you would love using a computer. Computers were somehow going to make me happy. And so I naively and enthusiastically, and this is several years ago, but I was a blank slate in terms of computers. I had not, we owned a big one that the kids used, but I didn't know how to use it. So I went out and I bought a laptop. It's the Get Wired experiment, exactly. And took lessons at Apple on how to use the goofy, stupid thing. And I got a Facebook account and fell into the horrible rabbit hole that is electronics. There were times where, I do Twitter a lot. I like to think of jokes and post them. And it's not that I don't enjoy that aspect of it, I suppose. But there is, I began having problems with sleep. What's interesting about that chapter is that because I was a blank slate, I mean, now more and more they're finding out the detrimental effects of screen devices, particularly on the developing brain, but on all of us. You just look around. It's no question we're all addicts at this point. But because I was totally a blank slate, I didn't do this intentionally. But what I document in that chapter is a pretty awful slide into that, you know, the brain damaging effects of screen devices. And my son also, as is chronicled in the book, again, inadvertently, if I had known this was going to happen, I never would have participated. But I stupidly put my son in front of a computer when he was three because I didn't know any better. And because
that's... Because it's an effective babysitter
well,
for a half
I mean,
hour or so,
I can't
right?
tell you that I didn't enjoy the free time with him, yes. you know, engaged in something. But what I believed at the time is what they told us, which was...
You found the cough button.
I did find the cough button. I feel really proud of myself. I've been in radio for a while. Those machines made their way into our schools and our homes under the deceptive cloak of the word educational. And that's what I thought I was doing for my son when I put him in front of a computer. And in fact, it was a terrible thing. It caused and I never bought him an iPad. He never owned a smartphone. All we had was the one big computer, and you had to ask permission to use it. So it wasn't rampant at all. But it did cause, he has very severe electronics addiction, which is a real thing. And that story ends up being told in my book as well.
Yeah. And we've just got 2 minutes left. But you do have a big screen experiment in your book that I just have to ask you about as one of your experiments to see if it makes you happy. You and your three kids watch movies for an entire 24 hours straight. Now, who told you that would be a good idea?
Well, it wasn't quite 24 hours, but it was long. It was really long. Me and my kids, you know, I didn't allow them to watch television growing up, and we only watched like a movie on video or DVD back then on a non-school night. So the idea of watching something during the day was pretty that was a very exotic idea to us as a family, and we were convinced that this was the one, that if we could just watch whatever we wanted for a whole day, we'd be, you know, we'd be in pig heaven. And the truth is, it was fighting and arguing and fractious and difficult, probably for the first few hours, and eventually, I like to feel that it was my choice of the in-laws that finally brought us around, and in the end, I finally went to bed while the kids were still watching *An I Love Lucy*, and I just laid in bed and listened to them laugh, and it was one of the greatest sounds I've ever heard.
How old is your youngest child?
My youngest is now 19.
19. So you and three people, 19 to 26, all managed to agree.
No,
on the
they
same
were younger
things.
Than that then.
This story
took place over the course of 7 years.
Oh, I see.
So I don't recall how, I mean, I think Allie was still in high school, I think, and he would have been then, you know, maybe middle school, and Tosha was still, no, they were all still living at home.
So is there a 30-second takeaway at the end of all this for how to find happiness that
persists
even when you stop doing the thing?
Yeah. Okay. First of all, buy my book. That'll be fun. I think it's a fun read. Put your flat thing down. Stay away from your computer. Not all the time, maybe, but make some rules for yourself, for heaven's sakes. Greet one another. Make eye contact. Shake hands. Give people hugs. Get some exercise. New Yorkers are good at exercise anyways. I think those are the key things. And have a life of purpose. Do some volunteer work.
Paula Poundstone nails it. Nails the earnest message in the context of being really, really funny. So the book is called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
We finish up this morning with a conversation about the Tony-nominated Broadway play Sweat, which I saw right after it opened at the end of March. Enjoy. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and obviously, since Donald Trump became a leading candidate for president and then president, understanding the mostly white working class communities that so many Trump voters came from has become something of an obsession for the media, so much of which failed to grasp the extent of the anxiety and anger of a broad swath of Americans until after the election. Sweat, the playwright Lynn Nottage's new Broadway play, now at Studio 54, zeroes right in on it. I saw Sweat over the weekend, and it delivers a very keenly observed portrait of a city grappling with the effects of deindustrialization in the Pennsylvania Rust Belt through the stories of its characters. Here with me now are the Pulitzer Prize-winning Sweat playwright Lynn Nottage. She won for her 2009 play Ruined about conflict in Congo, and the actor Michelle Wilson, who plays the lead character, Cynthia, in Sweat. Hi, Lynn. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
And Michelle, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm having that experience of when you've only seen somebody as a character and now you see them in real life.
You want to have a drink with me?
But wait, yes, you're Cynthia, that woman from the factory who, yeah, I won't give away the plot. So this is your Broadway debut, Lynn. Congratulations.
Thank you, indeed.
And the New Yorker reviewed this play as the first theatrical landmark of the Trump era. But I see you spent 2.5 years in development of the play, so you probably started with Donald Trump the furthest thing from your mind. Yes?
Right. When I first went to Reading, Pennsylvania in 2011, I don't think that Donald Trump was more than a reality television star with aspirations.
And why did you go to a fading steel town?
Well, I guess this journey really began with a commission that I received from Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which invited a group of playwrights to think very expansively about American revolutions. And at the time, I wasn't sure which revolution I specifically wanted to focus on. And then I received a letter one evening from a friend of mine who lived a couple doors down from me, who basically said that she was struggling. And she was the mother of two and didn't really want anything from us, but wanted to let us know that she was in trouble. And it really sort of made me very sad to think about someone who was living with economic security, living so close to me in Brooklyn. And I ended up calling her the next morning and going to Occupy Wall Street with her. And we sort of marched around. And at the end of the day, it sort of produced this hunger to understand how economic stagnation and economic insecurity was really sort of shifting the American narrative. And I wanted to find a city that I felt was really representative of that.
So Reading, the poorest American city of that size, according to the Census Bureau in 2011. What did you find when you went there?
You know, when I went to Reading, it was sort of surprising because as you drive into the city, what you see at first is this very beautiful city, which is sort of a mixture of colonial homes and mid-20th century homes. And so you don't see sort of the poverty on the surface. And I began asking questions from everyone from the mayor to folks who ran the United Way to folks who ran businesses. And what I found was a city that was very fractured along racial and economic lines, and a city that really wanted to share its story but felt relatively invisible.
And listeners, if you want to talk to Lynn Nottage, anyone listening who's already seen Sweat or is a fan of Lynn Nottage's previous work or is from Reading or wants to reflect on the issues of fading industrial America and how would you like to see them represented in theater and other arts, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Lynn is here with the actress Michelle Wilson, one of the leads in Sweat. So if you want to talk to either of them, 212-433-9692. Michelle, learning your part, did Lynn take you through, and the director, who I haven't even mentioned.
The director is Kate Wierski, who's a longtime collaborator.
And so
brilliant.
Are you learning politics? Did you, as the cast members, go out to Reading also, or are you just, like, learning your lines?
All of the above. When we started, there was some great dramaturgy, and Lynn had done so much research and interviews, so we had packets. And then you have this incredibly dense human text that you have to begin on. But also, I'm from Detroit. So my city was a canary in the coal mine years ago with deindustrialization. So I knew these people, and I knew the struggle. One of my earliest memories is it had to be during the gas crisis. And I remember they were sending counselors into the schools to deal with children because the families were so depressed. because of losing their jobs. So this has always been with me. I'm from a company town.
Hmm. And I see that in a conversation between cast members posted on the SWEAT website, referring to the poverty and anxiety in the Rust Belt. You said, how did I not know this, and what can I do? And I think a lot of people in our listening area especially may be thinking the same thing. Mm-hmm. How do you answer your own question?
I feel like sometimes we forget how large this country is, right? And we're in our own little pocket of existence. And so we can forget what our neighbors are going through or not be aware, right? But everybody wants the same things. And there's a quality to it where I think it makes people feel incredibly vulnerable to admit that we're all on an edge, right, economically. Because most of us are striving and working hard, but we don't have the same obstacles of a company closing and not having options.
So, Lynn, having immersed yourself in this kind of community, were you less surprised than maybe a lot of other New Yorkers when Donald Trump was actually elected?
I will begin by saying I was very surprised that he was elected, but I was not surprised that he had as much support that he had. Because the stories that I heard were very similar to the stories that we now are quite familiar from the headlines. It's a large swath of the white population that feels terribly disaffected, that feels marginalized and invisible. And that's certainly what I encountered when I was talking to people in Reading.
Let's take a phone call. Sarah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had heard that Sweat was a play I should see. I'm a recent arrival in New York and didn't know really what it was about. But I was on a bus that actually went to Reading campaigning for Hillary Clinton during the campaign, saw the city, saw what had happened. And a group of us went out and you sort of separate. And we were waiting for some people. And the person I was with said, let's go in this bar. So we ended up listening to a guy who was a patron at the bar, the bartender, and it was actually the bartender was very intelligent. It was the guy sitting at the bar who was actually he was a union person. He was working for Hillary, but he had a lot of complaints and a lot of strong feelings.
It's amazing that you're telling this story, and my guests are both sitting here smiling and laughing, as am I, because we know that so much of the play is set in a bar where community members from this, troubled factory go to hang out. So you're right in that, you're more in the wheelhouse than you really even know. So what was your takeaway from Reading, Sarah?
Well, in a sense, it was just, there were parts of the city that were actually beautiful, but I shouldn't say that, actually beautiful, as if it couldn't be. But since I knew it was a Rust Belt city, I was surprised to see the parts that were pretty, and then the parts sort of where there were bars and some fair, quite rundown storefronts, mm-hmm. things like that. You
okay.
could see the different parts.
I'm going to leave it there, Sarah. Thank you very much. Kisa in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I saw it on Friday, and I thought it was fantastic.
Thank you.
I thought it was really great to see how Lynn kind of juxtaposed race and class, because you see in the bar an African-American lead who's a dear friend with two white women. And so I love the idea that race can transcend, rather friendship can transcend differences. But then it kind of falters when one kind of wants to supersede her economic class. And there were some obvious tensions there, so I really appreciated the fact that the play delved into those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cynthia,
Michelle, as your character, Cynthia, and I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but Cynthia, who's black, works in a factory alongside her friends, who in the play are white, and eventually Cynthia gets promoted to management, a traditionally white world where jobs are passed from father to son. How did you inhabit what the caller was describing, what Cynthia must have been thinking, including her conflict between her new job in management and her loyalty to her union friends still working on the factory line?
We just all have ambition. And my thinking is that Cynthia is doing everything you're supposed to do. Right? She graduated high school, got married, had a family, started working in the factory, and wanted more. And it's like the American dream. and hers becomes a nightmare. It just starts unraveling. But I would like to say that it's there's also this class dynamic, right? So her and her friends have been on the line for years together, and it's when someone is trying to step out of the class as well. You know, it's what Lynn does so brilliantly in this piece is that you can't just pull one thread. So there's class, and there's race, and there's, you know, a community, and there's all these issues, immigration, that are on top of each other and compounding each other. So it's there's no oversimplified or pathologized view of these human beings.
I actually want to play a clip of Donald Trump, since Reading is a steel town, announcing a rollback of climate emission rules designed to bring back coal mining jobs. But he also said this.
This came up a little bit coincidentally when I was signing the pipeline deals. I'm all signing. I've got them done. And I said, folks, where do we get the steel? And they said, I think it's from foreign lands. I said, no good. Who makes it? Who makes those beautiful pipes for the pipeline? So they're made outside of this country. I said, no more, no more. So we added a little clause, didn't take much, that you want to build pipelines in this country, you're going to buy your steel and you're going to have it fabricated here.
So Lynn Nottage, after immersing yourself in the politics and economics of Reading, including steel jobs going to Mexico, does that kind of thing, no matter what else you might think of Donald Trump, get you hopeful, like he's also trying something that the usual politicians wouldn't, to help communities like the one portrayed in Sweat?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, so I cling to what's positive in that speech, but I don't know that it's necessarily going to happen. I'm not entirely confident that those steel jobs are going to be able to come back to those communities, and I really think that sort of incumbent upon the politicians, particularly in that region, to begin to think more creatively and expansively about how to create jobs.
Joan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joan.
Thank you for taking my call. I am of the theater, and I want to thank
Lynn
for this extraordinary play.
Thank you.
My feeling that our art really makes an enormous change in our social attitudes. And I felt, as I was seeing the play, that if it had opened before the election, it would have had enormous impact on voters. So thank you, Lynn. It was just extraordinary, and I'm going again next week.
Thank you.
That's so lovely.
Thank you very much. And here's Amanda in Manhattan, but from Reading. Hi, Amanda. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. You know, I think it's wonderful that the play is about Reading and, you know, looking at, you know, sort of these very disenfranchised people that have, you know, are sort of the ex-coal miners. However, I think that if you really want to delve into the areas of Pennsylvania and places like West Virginia, you have to go to places like Schuylkill County, Monoy City, Georgeville, Shenandoah, where you truly have abandoned towns. And, you know, these are the people that now struggle with opiate addictions and meth and heroin.
Right,
which
is also represented in the play.
Yes.
Amanda, what do you think those towns actually need at a policy level?
I think that, you know, they have started to do some wind turbine projects in Shenandoah. I think more of that is important. I think, you know, looking at the overall industries in those areas, things like automation could potentially come in. But you're also looking at the real need for education. Unfortunately, these areas are so poverty-stricken that the tax dollars are really not there to go into robust public education, which I think is generally a probably a problem in this country in rural areas as a whole. So if I were to say those three things would probably be the solution.
Thank you very much. We have 2 minutes left before the end of the show with Lynn Nottage, the playwright of Sweat, and Michelle Wilson, who plays one of the characters. The theater, Studio 54, it's the first time I saw a play there. I know it as this legendary club from the 80s. And now it's a Broadway theater.
But it was also a television studio prior to being a club. So it has a very interesting history.
And it's small. It seemed like it was very intimate. I don't know if it's smaller than other Broadway theaters, but it seemed like an intimate space. I don't know. How's that space to play in?
Oh, it's a lovely space. It has good ghost in that Broadway house. It's been such a positive experience, but it's Studio 54 works. We're working artists on stage, talking about people who are disenfranchised, who've worked for their lives. But the building itself, you know, the front staff and all of the, you know, dressers, it's a beehive of activity. So it's a perfect reflection of we're working on stage. Lynn wrote a piece for working artists, and everybody from the building, you know, down is working.
And it was at the Public previously. So different audience?
It's a very different audience, and it's been a sort of a tremendous audience because the majority of people are there not because they subscribe but because they want to be there. And you feel that energy. At least I do when I'm sitting in the audience, and I'm sure that's true for you, Michelle, when you're standing on stage. And can I just add one thing just about the intimacy of Studio 54 is that our designer, John Lee Beatty, I think did a fantastic job of really bringing the play forward so that people feel like they're sitting in that bar.
And you get to show it by being on Broadway, I think, to more people from all over America. That's funny because you're not on television, you're not on a network, but on Broadway you get the tourists.
Which is great. The other day I was sitting in the audience with some folks who didn't know I was a playwright, and at intermission the circle of people began talking about the play, and one woman said, "What do you think?" Another woman said, "I think it's great. I think it's so wonderful to see these folks who I know on stage, and this is my first Broadway show." That's thrilling.
That's really great. Playwright Lynn Nottage, whose latest is Sweat, at Studio 54, and Michelle Wilson, who plays one of the lead characters. Cynthia, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
On. Good luck with the run.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Since this conversation, Sweat has been nominated for this year's Tony Award for Best Play, and Michelle Wilson is one of two actresses in the cast to be nominated for Best Featured Performance. Good luck to both of them, and have a great weekend, everybody.